Bartholdt Kuyken, who said that it was the flute that taught him how to play on it. Playing there a traverso, a Baroque flute, a sonata by Johann Muthel.
Henry Ford Community College has been providing excellence in education for 70 years. As the college celebrates its 70th year, keep an eye on hfcc.edu for upcoming events related to the anniversary, including a special concert on February 28, 2009. Achieve your dreams, and it starts with a visit to hfcc.edu or by calling 1-800-585-HFCC. Start your education at Henry Ford Community College, your best choice guaranteed.
It can be hard being a teenager. Social pressures, like the media standard of beauty, often diminish individuality and lower self-esteem. Hi, my name is Garen Wolf, and I'm a freshman in college. Back when I was in middle school, I noticed that girls with older sisters and brothers were often better at managing schoolwork, exploring opportunities, and getting along with other girls. So, with my parents' help, I founded the Official City Prep Mentoring Program. Official City Prep helps middle school girls of all races improve their self-esteem, do better on standardized tests, and deal with social challenges. How do we do it? We pair 6th and 8th grade girls with seniors in high school. It's not hard to make a difference. Get out and live. Volunteer.
Brought to you by the Hitachi Foundation's Yoshiyama Award for Exemplary Service to the Community and this station.
Hello, hello.
It's good to be back. It's good to be back.
And hello, hello to you. This is Lynn, your host of No Boys Allowed, heard right here on WHFR 89.3. That's No Boys Allowed, where we explore the music of female artists who sing, who act, who play musical instruments, who speak quotable quotes. You'll even hear a recipe you might just like. Tune in every Saturday afternoon from 1 until 3 for No Boys Allowed with your host, Lynn, right here on WHFR, the station making waves. Where's that measuring cup?
Hello, this is John Wesley Harding, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn.
Hey, loyal listeners. We know you tune into WHFR to hear the best in new music that you won't hear on other stations. But the last week of 2008 will be even better. From Friday, December 26th, to Thursday, January 1st, our DJs will be playing their personal favorites. The best tracks from the best albums released over the past year. Be sure to tune in and ring in 2009 by hearing the best of 2008. Right here on the only station making waves, WHFR.FM.
Basic Concepts of Music, an audio print series funded by the Annenberg CPB Project. This program is titled Putting It All Together, and your faculty host is Professor J. Peter Burkholder.
We've come a long way in this series. In the first several programs, remember, we learned about such basic concepts as rhythm, melody, harmony, and form, and then we saw how they all work together in music. Since then, we've dealt with several other concepts, such as texture, timbre, meaning, emotion, and style. Now it's time again to review and assimilate the most recent concepts we've discussed. So let's begin this program with a chorus from Handel's Messiah. And as we listen, I'll try to describe what's happening in the music using the concepts we've learned. The tempo is quick. The rhythm goes tick, tick, ticking along, motor-like, what H. Wiley Hitchcock called sewing machine music. The notes are very short, not sustained. The texture is varied through the alternations of the choir with the orchestra and chordal sections with polyphonic sections. Different groups of singers come and go. The harmony is simple, in a major key. The chords change quickly. The timbre is bright. It's a light sound. The violins are very prominent. The melody is broken up into short segments. There's lots of repetition. Some parts of the melody are very florid, with lots of quick notes, many notes on a single syllable. The mood is very energetic, lively, bright, active. Now suddenly everything changes. The tempo is slow, the rhythm deliberate and steady. Instead of short notes, everything is sustained, legato. The melody is continuous, with only one note on each syllable, drooping lines, none of the variety of the earlier music. The harmony is in a minor key and full of pungent dissonances. The timbre now is dark, the sound heavy. The texture is continuous, unchanging, no longer polyphonic but homophonic. The mood is somber, almost gloomy. What a dramatic change! Almost every aspect of the music changes, and yet we're still in the same piece. Handel is using these changes in tempo, rhythm, melody, harmony, timbre, and texture to create a sudden change of mood that brilliantly illustrates his text and brings it alive. Like sheep, we have gone astray, but the Lord hath laid on him the iniquity of us all. Today we'd say that this piece is in Baroque style, but Handel's listeners in the 18th century would have heard a change here, not just of mood, but of style. The chorus starts with the sewing machine music that is so typical of Baroque fast movements, and then changes to a slower, more formal choral style that evokes the restrained Renaissance style of two centuries earlier. What does this example show us? That all the concepts of music we have studied interrelate, that they work together to create a mood. And when all of these factors change, we can hear a change of mood or even a change of style. In this chorus from Messiah, Handel uses these changes of mood and of style to bring the text to life. Composers also use mood and style to bring characters to life and to represent dramatic conflicts in music. We can hear this, for instance, in a later work from the 18th century, Mozart's opera, The Magic Flute. When you meet someone for the first time, you can tell a lot about them by the way they act, the way they talk, and the way they dress. In an opera, when a character comes on stage, you have even stronger cues in the music they sing and in the music that surrounds them. For instance, what would you say about this fellow? Lively tempo, light texture, dance-like rhythm, simple melody and harmony, short repeated phrases, a tune in folk style, easy to remember or to whistle. So what can you tell about this character? Kind of simple guy, young probably, jolly, carefree, good-natured, and certainly not a member of royalty. No king or prince would sing such a folk-like tune. In fact, he's one of the comic characters, the bird catcher, Papageno. Now, who's this? Yeah. much slower tempo, fuller texture, more stately rhythm, longer phrases, very dignified. Certainly not unhappy, but not jolly and carefree either. It's a much more formal style, stately and solemn, appropriate to a position of rank and importance. This is the high priest, Sarastro, praying to the gods, and his music reveals the nobility and dignity of his character. And who is this? Faster tempo, agitated rhythms, sudden dynamic changes. She's excited. Minor key, more complicated harmony. She doesn't sound happy. Angular melody, very wide range. She sounds angry. She sounds like she's accustomed to getting her way, pounding away on one note, then flying off the handle melodically, demanding what she wants. This is a very dramatic and elaborate style, suitable for a powerful and jealous woman. This is the queen of the night, in one of her fits of rage, seeking vengeance on Sarastro. Papageno, Sarastro, and the Queen of the Night are all characters in the opera The Magic Flute. We come to know each one not only through their words, but through the way they sing them, that is, their musical styles. Styles that carry associations, like Papageno's folk music style with simple rural folk, or Sarastro's noble and formal style with religious ritual. If the Queen of the Night sang a folk song, we wouldn't believe she was a queen. But if Papageno sang like she does, we wouldn't think he was a very comic figure. So the more sensitive we can be to the varieties of musical style current in the 18th century, the more we can catch these references and learn about each character's history and personality. Now already, just in these short excerpts, we can sense that there is tension and conflict between these characters. These conflicts are played out and resolved both on the stage and in the music. Each character is represented by a distinctive musical style encompassing many aspects of their personalities. And yet, Mozart assimilates all of their musical styles into a single work of art, a single world populated with very diverse characters who somehow learn to live in harmony. In the overture to this opera, The Magic Flute, before the opera begins, Mozart introduces this idea of conflicts between many different characters, moods, and styles, and of the ultimate resolution of those conflicts. Even though there are no words, no characters on stage, and the curtain is closed, the music is enough to guide our imagination because it arouses associations in our minds. We hear music in a noble style, slow and dignified. This makes me think of Sarastro's music. Then there's a much busier, comic style. It's hard to imagine singing anything but a comic text to music with so many quickly repeating notes and sudden dynamic changes. It's like a duet Papageno sings with his wife-to-be, Papagena. Papageno. The comic idea in the overture is later transformed into a more dramatic and exciting mood. And it continues to get stormier and more intense. This mood is similar to the Queen of the Night's aria. So we have a preview in the overture of many of the styles, moods, and characters we will encounter in the opera. We don't know yet who these characters will be, but we are being prepared to expect nobility, comedy, drama, excitement, and even rage. How does Mozart hold all of this variety together? Through form. The overture is in two parts, a slow introduction, followed by a fast section in sonata form. In the fast section, we can hear the contrasts of rhythm and melody and harmony that we talked about when we discussed sonata form in an earlier program. But what's even more obvious when we listen are the strong contrasts in texture and timbre and mood and even style. We can find here the various parts of sonata form, the exposition, development, and recapitulation. And within the exposition, the subparts that we would expect to find, a first theme in the tonic key, then a transition that changes key to the dominant, followed by a second theme and a closing theme. But what we really notice, what makes the form really clear and makes the music easy to follow, is these changes in texture, timbre, mood, and style. Let's listen to the exposition and hear how this works. After the slow introduction in the noble, serious mood and style, the exposition itself begins with the first theme in a lively comic style. The texture is relatively thin, just the melody and violins alone. Then other string instruments join in with the melody, and the texture slowly builds. Then the texture and mood dramatically change as the transition begins. It's suddenly louder. The woodwinds and brass join in, and the whole orchestra is playing. The music becomes more exciting, and the tension builds. The texture suddenly thins. It's much softer, and we begin to hear the second theme in a more lyrical mood, using the timbre of woodwind instruments in contrast to the strings that played the first theme. The second theme has a loud cadence, and then it repeats. The music becomes agitated again and drives forward to a final cadence. This is the closing theme of the exposition. The rest of the movement works the same way. Changes of texture, timbre, mood, and style make the form easy to follow. So, just as Mozart builds his opera out of these strong dramatic contrasts between characters and between musical moods and styles, he does the same thing in miniature in his overture. And just as all the characters, as different as they are, can exist in the same world, so he draws all these different moods and styles into a single movement, a single overture, with a clear form. We've talked about style, about mood, and about form. Now let's talk about the meaning of this music. Mozart's opera, The Magic Flute, is an allegory of an ideal society, where, without destroying individuality, all tensions are resolved and all oppositions drawn into unity. Mozart sums up this allegory in the overture by unifying contrasting musical styles and moods. But he does more than that. Mozart knew that his audience in late 18th century Vienna would think of the Baroque style of earlier generations as fussy and old-fashioned in comparison with the very latest classical style. And so he mixed a Baroque form and a classical form in order to reinforce his message that seemingly incompatible ideas can be unified. The typical classical overture has a slow introduction and a fast section in sonata form. The typical Baroque overture has a slow section followed by a faster section in the form of a fugue. What Mozart does here in the fast section of his overture is to superimpose a fugue over his sonata form, so that the overture simultaneously follows the conventions of his own time and the older Baroque era. This is the way a fugue usually begins. We hear the main idea, called the subject, played alone, and then the whole melody is imitated in other instruments, entering one after the other. The first theme of Mozart's exposition sounds like a fugue. Here's the subject, played by half of the violins. The rest of the violins join in with the subject in the dominant key. The violas and cellos enter with the subject in the tonic. And the basses bring in the subject again in the dominant. In a typical fugue, there follows a series of episodes, in which we hear fragments of the fugue subject interspersed with other material. And that's what we hear next in Mozart's overture, too. The transition of the sonata form is at the same time an episode in the fugue, passing the fugue subject between instruments and alternating it with other musical material. As the overture continues, we can hear the fugue subject returning in various keys and in various guises, alternating with episodes of other material. But we can also hear the exposition, development, and recapitulation of a sonata form. This overture is simultaneously a perfectly proper fugue and a perfectly proper sonata, combining the constant rhythmic drive typical of Baroque music with the phrase structure and internal divisions that characterize classical music. This is music that succeeds in reconciling two forms and two styles at once. The individual characters of the Baroque fugue and the classical sonata are not destroyed, nor does one give way to the other. Instead, the two coexist. It's a pretty neat trick, and it's a way that Mozart could represent, through music alone, his vision of a good society, a world in which even the most apparently different ways of being can be brought into unity. While Mozart shows how individuals can coexist in society by reconciling different musical styles within standard forms, our next example, composed some 40 years later, celebrates the freedom of the individual from society's rules and regulations by including a wide range of performing styles in an entirely novel form. This is Chopin's Ballade in G minor for piano. Ballade means ballad in French. By using this name, Chopin suggests that the music will tell a story without following any preset form. The piano is the perfect instrument to celebrate the individual. A single player can produce all the pitches of an orchestra, a variety of sounds and textures, and a great range of dynamics, from the softest whisper to a thunderous barrage. And unlike an orchestra, a single player can change or even make up the music while playing. This piece captures that sense of individual freedom so typical of the early 19th century. And as we hear Vladimir Horowitz play, we can even imagine that we're overhearing Chopin himself improvising at the piano. The ballade begins with an unaccompanied melody that sweeps up three octaves, as if the music were making space for itself. The performing style is at first bold and confident, but soon becomes more tentative. At first, it sounds like the piece will be loud, in a major key, and in duple meter. But then, as if changing his mind, the pianist quiets down, moves to a minor key, and starts the first theme in a dance-like meter of 6 beats per measure. The tempo is slow, the performing style delicate and free. As the pianist pulls at the beat, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Now the theme repeats. The restrained, slightly uneven pulsation of the accompaniment under the melody helps to convey a pensive and unsettled mood. Now, instead of a simple repetition, Chopin begins to vary his theme, moving in new directions with both melody and harmony. The accompaniment becomes more active, the performing style more aggressive, the harmony more chromatic, the music more unpredictable, as if the pianist were thinking out loud at the keyboard, letting each new thought interrupt the last in a free and unfettered reverie. A surprising chord, a sudden burst of virtuosity in a very different style of performance. Every gesture a highly personal statement, and the first theme comes to a close. A gently rocking rhythm introduces a new idea and a more fluid performing style. As the new idea repeats, it gets louder and faster as the tempo accelerates. As the tempo increases, the mood becomes turbulent, the performing style more impetuous, almost violent, and the music becomes very difficult to play, so that only a highly skilled performer can manage it. Here again, the spotlight is on the individual, showing off his prowess as a virtuoso performer, as well as seeming to share his innermost thoughts. After this outburst of virtuoso fireworks, the music quiets down again, and we hear the second important theme, played in a much gentler, more lyrical style. As in the first theme, the texture is melody with accompaniment, but here the melody is more connected and song-like, the accompaniment smoother, and the key is major instead of minor, making the mood happier and more serene. So far, Chopin has given us two principal themes, strongly contrasted in rhythm, melodic contour, key, and mood, just as in an 18th century sonata. But instead of following a standard form like the sonata, Chopin creates a unique form based on the same principles of repetition, contrast, and variation. Instead of a development section, we hear the two themes in new guises, followed by a long, virtuosic explosion full of completely new material. When the themes return, near the end of the piece, their order is reversed. The second one comes first, and each is in its original key. This is just the opposite of sonata form, where the second theme is shifted into the key of the tonic. The piece ends with completely new material, an impassioned virtuosic coda in a new tempo and meter. Everything here shows an individual imprint, the unique form, the sense of improvisation, the many changes of tempo, mood, texture, and performing style. Instead of reconciling the differences in his music, as Mozart does in The Magic Flute, Chopin revels in them, using every element of music to celebrate the unique, unpredictable, constantly changing nature of the individual human being. What Chopin does in this ballade illustrates the growing interest in individual personality and psychology during the 19th century. But it also shows that contrasting rhythms, melodies, keys, textures, feelings, and styles can be combined in many different ways to convey many different meanings, from the religious message of Handel and the social optimism of Mozart to Chopin's passion for personal expression.
This program, titled Putting It All Together, was written and hosted by Professor J. Peter Burkholder of Indiana University for the series Basic Concepts of Music. Produced by Ralph Johnson, with technical production by Marv Nunn, project director and script editor Linda Clauter. This audio print course was developed by the University of Wisconsin Extension through Wisconsin Public Radio, the Independent Study Program, and the University of Wisconsin-Madison, with funds from the Annenberg CPB Project, providing opportunities for higher education through telecommunications.
The Trade and Apprentice Education Division of the Henry Ford Community College is excited to present a new 10-credit-hour renewable energy certificate program. The content of the courses will be structured to inform the students of both present and future renewable energy concepts. This certificate program should interest students who are looking for an alternative to our current reliance on fossil fuels. To learn more about this program, please contact the Trade and Apprentice Education Division at 313-845-9609 or on the internet at www.hfcc.edu.
Half of young Americans can't locate economic powers like Japan and India. 20% can't even find the Pacific Ocean. Without geography, our children aren't ready for the world. Geography is everywhere. It's incredible creatures. Rhythm. Fashion. Flavor. It's economics. And politics. It's change. Understanding connections between people and places is critical in the 21st century. That's why we created MyWonderfulWorld.org to give our kids the power of global knowledge. Go to MyWonderfulWorld.org for your free parent and teacher action kits. Because kids who understand our world today can succeed in it tomorrow.
The holiday season is officially here, and WHFR would like to remind our listeners that the WHFR online store is open 24 hours a day to help you with your holiday shopping. If you or someone you know loves WHFR, we can't think of a better gift for them than one of our quality WHFR logo products. Choose from items such as t-shirts, sweatshirts, hats, coffee mugs, and much more. Some items on the site now feature our new limited edition logo, expressing your support for non-commercial independent media. These items will only be available for a limited time, so check out our online store today by visiting www.whfr.myshirtdesigner.com. Remember, every purchase from our online store helps us continue making waves. Thanks in advance for your support, and from our family to yours, have a great holiday season.
This is A.J. Croce on WHFR.FM.
12th and final program in the series Basic Concepts of Music, funded by the Annenberg CPB Project. Your host for this program, titled Making Choices, The Empowered Listener, is Professor David Myers.
The musical scene is a little bit like a cafeteria nowadays. I mean, you go into a cafeteria and out of a zillion choices of food, you pick the things you like. And you also probably try different things if you go regularly to such a cafeteria.
That's jazz historian and composer Gunther Schuller, and I'm David Myers. Our goal in this series has been to help make you a more confident listener, an empowered listener, more informed and better prepared to understand and enjoy the great range of music available today.
The point is to go shopping and to listen to as many diverse musics as one possibly can, and then out of that make one's choices out of an intelligence, out of a knowledge of what exists. But I would like to suggest that one's own personal private initiative is just as important in seeking out knowledge about the diversity of musics on the face of this globe.
One aspect of personal initiative is being aware of how we listen and how our approaches to different kinds of music can vary, consciously and subconsciously. On this program, we'll summarize the basic concepts and vocabulary you've learned about music. We'll consider some of the many ways people listen to music. And we'll talk about musical taste and how it can grow and expand as you listen and apply the concepts from these programs. First, let's consider some of the ways of listening, from active and passive to analytical, functional, and even critical listening. Remember the Pachelbel Canon from the Harmony program? One way to listen to this piece is to focus on the harmony in the bass line. Besides listening for the harmonic structure, you could also listen for the polyphonic texture, like this. The first violin introduces a melody. And the second violin imitates it. Analyzing the harmony, the texture, the form, or any of the other elements you've learned in these programs requires active and concentrated listening. You must actively participate in the aural experience and base your response on your musical knowledge. But as Gunther Schuller said, in our modern lives we have an enormous amount of music around us. In fact, it's impossible to listen actively to all the music we hear. Many times, music is used for what we call wallpaper music. It's used as background in the supermarket, in the waiting room, in an elevator, or while you wait on the phone. When music is there, but it seems you're not aware of it, that's passive listening. The next time you find yourself hearing background music, focus on it. Try to determine why someone chose this particular music for that purpose. What elements of the music make it appropriate for background use? Why would someone identify this particular combination of rhythm, melody, texture, tempo, and so forth as wallpaper music? Even though wallpaper music isn't chosen for active listening, you, the listener, can make a choice to listen actively if you wish. Of course, there are other ways of listening to music.
It's Good Morning Radio at exactly 6:15. It looks like a beautiful day with a high of 80, sunny skies, and a light breeze off the lake. A perfect day for a picnic.
When you set your clock radio to wake you up in the morning to music, this is functional listening. You deliberately choose music to put you in the right frame of mind to do something, like getting dressed and going to work. It can often be a struggle to choose the right mood music for a party or for a group of people coming to your house. What mood would you set for a romantic dinner for two? You could call this functional listening, but it's sort of a special romantic subcategory of that kind of listening. Of course, what is romantic is very subjective for each of us. It depends on many things, like your age, your interests, what's currently popular. Whatever you choose, however, the music is serving this specific function. And what about this next music? How would you describe the way you listen to it? Well, that's circus music, of course. It calls to mind clowns taking pratfalls, elephants standing on their hind legs, and death-defying feats on the high wire. There are lots of times when a little snippet of music can call up a flood of memories. This is listening in the associative mode. And here's yet another mode of listening. A sensitive and knowledgeable music lover listens with a critical ear. And this has to do with taste and with comparison. A music critic often compares one composer with another, or one performer with another, and in that process often reveals to us her or his taste in music. If you don't already, you might try looking for music reviews in newspapers and magazines. Ask yourself how the writers got to their particular viewpoints. What language do they use to talk about the music and the performance? How can that help you gain new insights about the music? Listening critically requires both knowledge and experience. Here's an orchestral performance of Bach's organ work, Toccata and Fugue in D minor. In the 1920s and 30s, the conductor, Leopold Stokowski, made arrangements of music by Bach for large symphonic orchestras. These versions became very popular. Today, however, many critics would disapprove of Stokowski's arrangements because in recent decades, with new research, tastes have changed. Today, for example, we find more performances of Bach's music on original or authentic instruments. This example may seem a little obvious, but it demonstrates that when you listen critically, you are thinking about the performer's tempo, the performer's interpretation, choice of instrument, actually almost anything to do with the performer's or the composer's choices. So these are a few of the various ways we listen to music: analytically, functionally, associatively, and critically. These aren't the only ways to listen to music. Perhaps you can think of others. As I said earlier, the critical mode of listening is largely a matter of taste, the listener's taste compared to the taste of the performer or composer. In our culture today, the common ground in listening is shaped by our easy access to a broad array of musical experiences. Musicians tour from coast to coast with the same concerts. We hear the same or similar music at national sports events, at weddings, at funerals, in all kinds of ceremonies, on national radio and TV shows, and on records and CDs. Gunther Schuller comments on the effect that modern communication and technology have on the amount of music that's available and around us all the time.
Every kind of music that has been produced on the face of this earth, not only recently but through the last 5,000 years, all exists in some form or other on recordings and to some extent on television and radio, so that all of the music that one might ever be able to be interested in and involved with and participate in is at our fingertips nowadays.
So this great amount and variety of music we have before us today confirms our need to continuously broaden and improve our listening skills. The music we choose to listen to, of course, is partially a matter of taste or preference. Where does musical taste come from? Why and how does it change? An important step toward becoming an empowered listener is self-knowledge, understanding why music interests us and why we listen the way we do. How are musical attitudes formed? It may begin before we are born, in the womb. There is evidence that before the fetus is born, it senses the mother's rhythms and probably even hears speech and music in a primal way. After you're born, as you grow from a child to an adult, the society around you has a profound influence on the stages of your development. If you were born in an African village, your ear might be tuned to sophisticated interlocking rhythms like this. And if you were born into a traditional Persian family, your mind might be imprinted with a certain musical scale. Just within the boundaries of the United States, think of the immense variety of musical subcultures. In each one, your musical consciousness would be formed differently.
Well, it's a bloody merry morning. Baby left me without warning sometime in the night. So I'm flying down to Houston with forgetting her the nature of my flight.
We ain't gonna give anybody any slack.
Try to keep us down, we're gonna come right back. And you know where
it's looking out on the morning rain. I used to feel so uninspired.
Whatever subcultures you've been a part of, your own musical history is an experience unique to one person in the world, you. Whether it's the wordless tune that Grandma always hummed while she baked an apple pie, or the Beach Boys hit that was in the air that unforgettable summer at the boathouse, certain music becomes your personal property. In my own experience, for example, one of the things my wife and I share is a strong affection for the music of 20th century English composer Ralph Vaughan Williams. This all began when, while we were dating, we had a number of opportunities to hear and participate in Vaughan Williams' music. Later, we were sure to include his song, The Call, in our wedding music. And over the years, we have shared our experience with others who also have special fondness for the music of Vaughan Williams.
Come my way, my truth, my life, such a way as gives us breath. A truth as ends all strife, such a life as killeth death.
So there is a personal history, a sort of unspeakable link with my wife, with very special friends, and with very special memories each time I hear this composer's music. So musical experiences affect how our taste comes about. But how do musical tastes grow and change? Here is the opening music of Lux Aeterna, or Eternal Light, by the Hungarian composer Georges Ligeti. It was written in 1966 and was used in the score for the film 2001: A Space Odyssey. So this isn't exactly new music, but it is a style that may still be new or unfamiliar to some people. Some of us will like it instantly. It will suit our taste. Some of us may not. We could leave our discussion at that, but let's pursue our question of taste. Let's say that this music is new. We've never heard it before, and it's not part of our past musical experience, and it doesn't fulfill our musical expectations. Would it be possible to acquire a taste for such a piece? First, we must choose to keep our minds and ears open to this new combination of sounds. We can listen for clues as to what the composer is trying to say in the music. Can we find a sense of form? Are there certain particular series of sounds that appeal to us? Where can we go to read or hear about the composer and this particular kind of music? Who can we discuss it with? And at a later time, after hearing other works with similar characteristics, we might find a new place for this piece in our musical taste. That's part of what Gunther Schuller means when he advises us to go shopping, to use our own initiative to explore and to try to understand what is new and untried for us. Our taste will grow and expand only through awareness and understanding. New musical ideas come to us every year, every season. If electronically synthesized sounds become more common to us, our tastes will likely respond. If world pop and touring artists from the third world suddenly catch the fancy of the record-buying and the concert-going public, we can find ourselves swept up in a craze for music we never heard of a year ago. In the late 80s in the United States, the Bulgarian women's chorus suddenly became a big hit in concert and on records. Why? Well, one good reason is that as social creatures, our musical tastes are influenced by trends in society. Whether it's the Bulgarian women's chorus, Michael Jackson, or Itzhak Perlman. We are influenced by the promotion of the concerts, by the packaging of the product. In music, as in most other activities, we want to be in harmony with others, our friends, our community, our society. We've been talking about the ways we listen to music, the ways our tastes are formed naturally, and the ways our musical choices change. Let's talk now about how music may be used to influence us in particular ways. Aristotle said that the most suitable melodies for training a youth are those that teach sedateness and manly ethos. Some people nowadays use music to try to make you a better citizen, or to make you feel more patriotic. And some think music will help convince you to buy their product or to vote for them. Does listening to Sousa's Stars and Stripes Forever make you feel patriotic or a better citizen? If you were a modern-day Aristotle, would you recommend this kind of music for the proper education of our youth? Or how about this piece? Perhaps it affects your feeling of patriotism in a different way from Stars and Stripes Forever. Why?
As I went walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway. I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me.
This land was
in today's world, there's an all-pervasive type of musical influence. Background music in television and radio commercials. Listen to this ad. What is the music telling you about the product?
It's the simple truth. Nothing can compare with the style and elegance of this fine automobile. Haven't you waited long enough?
A close relative of the product commercial is the political commercial. What do you think of the hidden musical message from an advertising agency to influence your opinion about a political candidate? Why did the ad agency choose this music? What subliminal or subconscious message did they hope to send?
My opponent in this primary campaign has wrapped himself in the flag and tried to make patriotism an issue. I know, and you know, that the real issue is drugs. Think about it before you vote this time.
What do you think? What effect was the music supposed to have? Next time you see a commercial on television, pay attention to the music. It's a little like opera. The music makes its own commentary on the action. So there are people who use music to influence our attitudes. There are even people who try to tell us how to think about music itself. Perhaps you even think that I'm trying to tell you how you ought to listen to music. Well, as you've listened to our faculty and commentators in these 12 programs, you may have agreed or disagreed with them. But we do hope that you can agree that the empowered listener is aware of both obvious and subtle ways that music and ideas are connected.
We are a part of God's great big family.
And the truth, you know, love is all we need.
We are the world. We are the children. We are the ones who make a brighter day. So let's start giving.
We can't always choose what music we hear, but we do have a choice in how we hear it. Let's evaluate what the empowered listener can do with the skills learned in this series. Where do you go from here? Remember, at the beginning of the program, Gunther Schuller said to just dive in. There are radio stations that play all kinds of music. Libraries and record stores also offer vast riches, says Schuller.
I can go into a record store and I can buy 3 different recordings of Afghanistani mountain shepherd music. I mean, to pick something terribly obscure. But it's wonderful music. And I can buy Japanese music and Indian music and American Indian music and Eskimo music and Argentinian and Peruvian music. And I can buy all the jazz that there is. And I can buy almost all the classical repertory from Perrotin, who wrote music in 1199, to something that somebody wrote a month ago, which has just been recorded. So this vast panorama of music is available to us. Yes, the answer is just dive in.
And not just by listening.
Now, it happens that there are any number of excellent histories of jazz, for example, that tell us very clearly who the great masters in the history of jazz have been and are. And there are at least 4 or 5 such books. There are also some books that are full of misinformation. But, you know, with a little bit of reading, one begins to find out very quickly who knows what they're talking about. So I think one has to complement one's listening with avid reading in these subjects.
Gunther Schuller. In these programs, we've presented the musical elements and concepts that